Hey everybody, thanks for tuning in. This is the first episode. I'm gonna use it more as an introductory episode for a new podcast that I'm launching called The Culture is Money. I appreciate you guys taking a listen and giving me your time, because in business and in life, I know time's very valuable. So the fact that you would take time out of your schedule to even give this a try or consideration, I am profoundly grateful. I figured this episode is going to be more of a free for all. I do have some notes jotted down, but nothing too expansive or too detailed. I wanted it to be kind of organic and natural. I didn't want to kind of make it seem stiff. I think that'll be the premise for a lot of the episodes that I have, whether it's just me and we're talking about a specific topic. I think should be expanded and gone into more in depth, or it's me along with a subject matter expert. I believe in structure, but I don't believe in rigid structure. I like flexibility, because the conversation should go naturally where they just end up. I thought I would spend some time on this episode talking about a couple of things. The concept of this podcast, how it came to be, how did I finally decide to launch it, because I had resisted it for a while, even though some social media followers have been saying for a while they thought I should do something like this. I just thought it wasn't my type of thing. I'm also going to give you a little bit of history on me, how I came to be passionate about finance, financial markets, financial literacy within the culture, as well as this all matters of money and the relationship the culture has with money. I'm also going to give you some professional experience of mine. I think that's only fair if I'm asking you to regard my opinion with a matter of respect and some type of weight, that I would give you the courtesy of knowing my professional and educational experience. That way you don't think I'm just out here out of my realm and out of my area of expertise. So I'll get started. This won't be an elongated podcast. I think in general, when I do these, it'll probably be about 35, 40 minutes. I was just thinking, today's era, asking people to sit down for an hour or plus, it's too much of an expectation. I don't think people's attention spans are that long. Not saying, it's just people like to get the information quickly and briefly without it having to be too stretched out and lengthy. So I'll start with the concept of the podcast. I don't think one thing kind of sparked it. I think I kind of just ended up here for years. For those of you who don't follow me on social media, for years I've always offered a various of opinions on different things, whether it be personal or political, and especially matters of finance. I would always just use the various social media platforms, whether it be Instagram and Twitter, especially. They're two of my favorite platforms, as well as Facebook sometimes, to offer opinion about interesting statistics that I've discovered or analysis that I've done, whether it be on financial matters, whether it be housing, investment, savings, credit card management, all areas of financial decision making. And they've been received one or two ways. There's kind of no middle ground. My opinions have always been very polarizing, because I have a very intense personality. I stand on anything that I say, and I don't give ground. You're not gonna change my opinion. So people tend to receive that one of two ways. They either respect it or want to know more, or they'll argue me down in the comments or the mentions and just kind of want to get into a petty dialogue about, you know, their opinion, which is their right, but I tend not to feed into it these days. When I was younger and I had time and I was in college, I definitely fed into it. But these days, I tend to avoid those type of exchanges, because it's just exercise in futility, really. Like, no one's going to change your opinion if you're kind of bogged down into it. So that's kind of the premise of when my opinions came, and when those people would ask, you know, they were interested in more details, and they would always say, oh, when can I get more information? Or I like the tidbits that you gave, but I wish you had a podcast where we could go more in detail with it and everything like that. And I resisted it for a lot of reasons, but specifically for me, I'm one of those people who I felt like that I am a financial mind. Like, that's my purpose. That's my passion. I don't stray out of things outside of that element. I'm not one of those people who believes in being a jack of all trades. Because I'm in finance, I shouldn't also be out here, you know, trying to run a medical firm and all that. I just don't believe in being in various aspects. And I thought podcasting was a specific industry for specific people. And my goal is when, you know, the book is done on my career and, you know, God willing, they write an autobiography about the, you know, the contributions that I made to finance and financial operations and analysis and personal financial literacy, that I am considered one of the greatest, if not the very best financial minds of my generation. Like, that is just my end goal. So podcasting to me just never really played into that, which is kind of funny because over the last couple of years, I've actually done some podcasting, not running it my own, but guest starring on other people's podcasts for the same reason that they wanted me to make my own. They like my opinion. They wanted me to, you know, offer a different perspective and a different flavor. Even back a couple of years ago, I think it was 2018, I co-hosted a podcast with another guy and two ladies, offering different opinions on things such as sports or celebrity happenings in the community, whatever thing like that. Not anything like this where it would be specifically on finance and the culture's relationship with it. But that was the first experience with it, which kind of probably led me up to this. This is going to be my first experience kind of editing and controlling all the dynamics of the podcast myself. So fair warning, I would ask that you guys bear with me because there are probably going to be some growing pains. The first, I'll say, couple of dozen episodes I give you guys are going to be an MVP. And in business term, an MVP stands for a minimum viable product, meaning that I'm tweaking it as I'm going along. It's going to be probably very raw. Sometimes I might go off kilter or off subject in the midst of giving you information, but I'm going to try to keep it as narrow and as focused as possible. In addition to like the audio quality, currently I'm using the Anchor app to record. I'm actually using it on my iPhone, but there is no mic outside of the one that comes on. You know, if you have an iPhone, you know that the mic's kind of built in. But I've actually, because I'm going to start trying to push out 4 episodes a month, I actually did just look into a podcasting kit that's going to come to work with my iPhone. So it's going to be a mic, a headphone, kind of, so I can give you guys the best quality as I'm building the audience. So I would just ask that you bear with me as we go through some of these, you know, these trial and error things. It's not going to be pretty or crisp in the beginning, but I promise it'll get there eventually and it'll be a good experience. In addition to the concept idea of the podcast, I came up with the name, the title, The Culture's Money, after bouncing some ideas off some marketing friends of mine. I went to college with two young ladies who are like my little sisters, and my cousins, actually, who I'm very tight with. And I threw around, you know, a couple of names I had been playing with, and I settled on this one because most of the opinions I offer are in relations to the culture's relationship with money. And to be clear, when I say the culture, I'm talking about the African-American culture, the Black culture, and the American dynamic and capitalistic and financial systems. The term the culture has been coined the last couple of years to reference the African American community, just because our culture is so rich and so vibrant that that has been, you know, the nickname that's been given to us by us or other cultures outside of it to kind of label our dynamic. So that's why I labeled and named the podcast that, because I thought it was a fitting name, because a lot of the things I'm talking about when I'm always talking about finance, it is about savings and investings and business operations and growing and creating generational wealth. And all of that has to do with the culture's money, its relationship to it, its handling of it, the loss of it. The Black community has $1.2 trillion in spending power, but you would not know it based off the state and the financial impoverishment of the community at various phases, you know, whether it be education, whether it be housing, savings accounts, and that thing of matter. So I think that's all about the concept of it and how I came to, you know, land on, you know, deciding to make the podcast. A little history about me. For starters, my name is Jamal Wendell Vitos. Yes, I gave you the whole government. I am currently 32 years old. I'm born and raised in Baltimore, Maryland. My passion for, well, it gives you some educational thing. I went to school in Baltimore. I went to Lake Clifton Eastern High School. I also graduated from the University of Baltimore with a business degree with a focus in finance in 2015. Some history about me is, like, I wasn't always the best student in my educational, you know, career. Actually, when I was about 18 months, the place I was living at with my mom and my brother, I actually got lead paint poisoning. And this was back in the 90s when that was actually very prevalent. And the doctors told my mother that I would never have a normal life, that I would need special help my entire life, and that I just would not function as a normal person. And my mother, being as stubborn and as church lady and Garfinger as she was like, the devil is a liar. And to her credit, when I started school, from the time as much as I can remember it's like kindergarten, my mother would always, when the teacher would give us, you know, study words on Monday, my mother would always go over those words with me when I got home from school and she had got home from work. She would go over the words with me. We would define them. She would give me practice tests. Like, this was in addition to what my school teachers were already doing. My mother would give me a practice test to make sure that, you know, I understood the words, the concepts, and all that. And for a while, I was getting hundreds on all of those, you know, despite what the doctor said that I wouldn't retain anything, to my mother's credit, I was doing pretty well. And when she could no longer do it, she got me back in there in special education, which back in those days, it had a negative connotation to it. Special education meant that you know, were slow, you were, you know, mentally challenged or something like that. But my mother just no longer had the capacity, because it was just me and her, to study with me as she would. So she got me in school help. And I think it was about fifth or sixth grade that I decided to ask her that I no longer wanted to be in special education, because what happened was the special education teachers would come get me from class, take me to another area where it would just be me and them and maybe one or two other students who were also in special education. And we would go over the things, but I felt isolated, you know, ostracized. So I told her that I didn't want to do it anymore. So again, to her credit, she had a conversation with me. She was like, okay, we'll try it. And if you fall behind, we're going to have to put you back. So after that, my education kind of just took off, because my mother got me magazines. I think it was like wrestling magazines, so I could read things. You know, she wanted me to be interested in it. So I read those and I would devour those things. Like every month, I couldn't wait for a new magazine to come because I like to read. And plus, you know, the pictures were good, but it gave me an excitement. The words in the paragraphs kind of described the pictures I was seeing. So that passion turned into my, I started to read a lot of history books, like ancient Rome, ancient Greek, ancient Egypt. And eventually I got into like autobiography books of famous business people, Reginald F. Lewis, Marcus Garvey, and Black Wall Street. And that's where my first taste of the ingenuity and the innovativeness of the culture came into my first realization. You know, I'd read the books on Egypt and I knew how people were, you know, great and innovative and discovered so many things. But this was my first taste in finance. Fast forward a little bit. I tried to go to college right after high school in 2005. But after my freshman year, a personal matter occurred where I kind of dropped out. So I worked from 19 to 23 before I went back to college. And in the midst of me doing this working, of course, the financial crisis happened in 2007 to 2009. But my first experience with investing occurred during that period. I bought my first security or shares in 2009. I never forget it. It was $500 worth of Sprint. And this had to be like February, March of that year. And I bought the Sprint stock and I actually forgot it. I bought it, put the $500 in there. And some months later, I think it was the end of the year, maybe January of next year, the money had grown from $500 to $3,500. Like the Sprint shares had gone up because if you recall back in that time, Sprint was so cheap because everything else was so cheap. I think I had bought 500 shares for a dollar each. So that was my first taste at investing, you know, stocks, securities. But I really didn't know what I was doing. I had just been watching CNBC and Bloomberg, and I was hearing these things about stocks, but I really didn't understand the concept. So after scoring big on that investment, I decided that I wanted to go back to school and study finance. So I went back to school in 2010. Again, I graduated in 2015 with a degree in finance, and that's when my financial career began. After that, I didn't get right into finance. Right after college, with most people, I couldn't find a job because this was like 2015, and you know, your first job after college is always hard to find. So the first job I had was I worked at Under Armour in their call center for about a year. In conjunction, I was also working for a grant-operated organization out of Johns Hopkins University called the Center for Government Excellence. They needed a research analyst. So this was my first experience as an analyst. So I would compile and analyze a lot of data for them. And about a year after doing this for both Under Armour and Johns Hopkins, I got a job working for MTA here in Baltimore, in the Maryland Transportation Administration, as a financial analyst. And there I was running their modes, what they consider like, you know, subway, bus. When I first got there, I was running bus and subway. And then after a colleague of mine left, I was running basically all of the modes because it was so few of us. So I was in charge of running a $700 million budget on a daily basis, like signing invoices, moving money around with very little supervision. And this was my first experience with large amounts of money management and budgeting on a large institutional organizational scale. After that, I decided I wanted, because of my history and love for Black Wall Street, I wanted to work for a Black financial institution. So I worked my way into a job at a FDFI, which is a community development financial institution, which are for community banks that serve undervalued communities, minorities, that type of thing. And it was one of the last 20 Black-owned banks in the nation. and it was located here in Baltimore. The funny story of how I actually got the job, after reading an article about the things that the HBCUs and the financial institutions were doing, I decided to start tweeting some of the black-owned banks. I was trolling, as you would call it. So I trolled them. And little did I know that the CAO, the Chief Administrative Officer, which is another way of saying COO of the black-owned bank here in Baltimore, ran that Twitter page. So he actually DM'd me the email address and had me contact his secretary to set up a meeting. I couldn't believe it. I thought this was the funniest thing ever. So we actually went to lunch, him, I, and the CFO of the bank. And we had a very productive conversation about my feelings about the black-owned banks and what they were lacking and how they were behind in the times and all that. And I didn't get a job right then and there. This would occur in like in April of 2017. And we would converse for a while, for the remainder of the year until about October and November when an opening came and they thought I would be perfect for it. And we negotiated some things and I wound up working for them, and I was there for about a year and a half. And after being there and getting all the experience I thought I could gain, I thought, okay, I know how this institution works. I need to see how bigger PWIs work in comparison so I could decide on my life's work how I wanted to improve the black-owned community banking institutions and how to get into that realm. So that's how I ended up in my current job in an investment firm as a financial analyst, and how I got my professional experience, my investing experience, and how I got all the financial management experience. Another thing I think I should make it a point of saying, because I think sometimes when talking about personal finance, especially on social media, people get the idea that people who are talking about investing and personal finance, that they're one, judging, and two, it's easy for them to talk because they don't have any debt or anything like that. So I want to clear those two myths up. One, I'm never judging. I may be harsh in my delivery sometimes. I might be very blunt because I just don't believe in sugarcoating. I'm very authentic. Though I'm professional, I'm very just raw and uncut. I don't believe in giving it to people politically correct, because sometimes people don't understand that. And they need to feel as though they understand where you're coming from. So you have to talk to them like a normal person. Like, don't talk to them like you're up and, you know, high and mighty. You have to deliver it to them in a way where they can feel like that you're a regular person. In addition to, being financially in a position that people can't relate, though I manage my finances well now, doesn't mean I don't have debt. I still have $80,000 in student loan debt that I've yet to tackle. But I have a plan on how to deal with that. I was once $12,000 in credit card debt that I've nearly wiped out through discipline and diligence and, you know, sacrifice. I've had things on collections that I've had to get off. I've you know, missed bill payments. You know, my 20s, you know, I didn't just come out responsible. So when I talk to people about financial literacy and financial management, I'm not talking it from a place of arrogance or inexperience. I've been where a lot of you have been, or a lot of you are, and, you know, still are. You know, statistics show that 43% of us who went to college have at least on average $20,000 to $25,000 of student loan debt. Some of us have more if you, you know, went to grad school and all of that. So my passion for it is not judgment. It's about all of us getting to that you know, debt-free freedom, generational wealth aspect. You know, I don't believe that you need to be debt-free before you start investing in stocks and mutual funds or real estate or starting a business, because I just don't think that's... You don't need to be debt-free. A friend of mine on Twitter, Todd Millionaire, always talks about using the income streams to pay off your debts. So that's where I come from. Here's a... I neglected to talk about. I also have entrepreneurial experience as well. So when I talk about, you know, business operations and everything like that, for that year that I was out of work after college, I started a startup, a male grooming products, because I felt like all of the products on the market were not for black men. Like, our beards and our textures are unique. We have coarse hair and everything like that. So I actually started a startup that's now defunct, but with a best friend from college, and I actually got us a $10,000 grant to kind of do a prototype from a foundation here in Baltimore called the Able Foundation. And it wasn't as complicated as I thought. I think the thing that that keeps people from taking those entrepreneurial risks is the perception of the red tape. They think because you have to jump through these hoops, or it has the appearance of hoops, that they kind of stray away from it. I did nothing but go on to the Able Foundation's website, submit a written summary of what I wanted to do, why I thought the grants that they were offering were applicable to my startup. And I got a meeting with the CEO. That's funny. It's not as hard to get the meeting with these local CEOs as you think. They're very accessible if you get their attention. So I had a meeting with the CEO. We had an honest discussion. He talked about, actually, when he gave me the grant, I knew I was going to get the grant before I left. When he said he gave me the grant, he says, "I'm going to give you the grant. I don't think that it'll be enough to get the company to where you want it to scale to, but I think it'll get you a start." And to his credit, he was correct. It wasn't that he was doubting me. He was giving his professional opinion. And not only did they give me the grant money, they also provided some resources for us to kind of grow the company. Our company went to a couple of business competitions where we placed, you know, we ranked. We got second place in one, third place in another. So I have that experience of business operation and, you know, losses. I think one thing about the entrepreneurial experience on social media, especially, people make it sexy. Like, if they're success, people just kind of make it appear that they woke up one day and they just went from 0 to 100 and they were just on the top of the mountain. No one talks about the failures, the lost monies, the debts, the company the company going out of business. And I talk about, you know, my failed entrepreneurial things with pride. Because I feel like that gives you just as much credibility as the success. The success is because you took the risk that other people weren't willing to. That sums up about everything about me that you would need to know about the podcast, my personal experience, my professional experience, the things I've done. I think, to give you guys a little tidbit, I'm strategizing my next move. I think I've reached the point through professional experience. I've been working since I was 16. I've reached the point where I'm about to pivot in a matter of things. Everything I do, everything I pivot to always has to do with finance. And I'm thinking it's time for me to pivot in the realm of the community financial banking institutions, for one, but also seed micro investing in Black-owned entrepreneurial startups. If you don't know, is that Black-owned startups only get, if anything, 2% of seed or venture or private equity funding for their business ideas, which is very, of course, is very disappointing considering that we're about 18% of the population in this country. At the very least, we should get 18% of investing in the entrepreneurial and the business aspect of the community. So I'm thinking about that, and this podcast isn't just and I say that to say this podcast isn't just about opinions, and me telling you what you should be doing, what you should be investing in. I want it to be a content recording of my experiences as well. I want you guys to experience entrepreneurial things that I'm doing, professional advancement or pivots or shifts. So it's going to be an interactive experience between the two of us, me as the host, you as the listeners, where I'm giving you information that you may not have known is out there, access to, you know, things that you didn't know, that if you're a potential entrepreneur ready to take that risk, you know, I want to be able to give you easy ways to access SBA loans, you know, how to bootstrap a company, how to, you know, reach angel investors or PE funds or venture funds or hedge funds even. But I also want you to find comfort in that you're not the only one out here struggling and trying to figure out how to make it work. I have goals, lofty goals, you know, and they scare the hell out of me. Why? Because they're so massive, and it's a high probability that I'll fail, but it's also a high probability that I'll succeed, because I'll take the risk that no one else will, or very few people will. I think that is about it for this introductory episode. I'm going to try to make another episode for you guys in a week or so. Like I said, I'm going to try to do 4 episodes a month. This is just the beginning. I'm not sure what our first topic will be next week. I'll probably brainstorm it over the next, probably the rest of today and tomorrow, and maybe use my various social media platforms to get you guys to give me some ideas that you want me to tackle. Again, it'll be either me. I think the first few episodes, maybe the first 5 or 6, it'll just be me to kind of get you guys familiar with my knowledge, my capabilities, my information, information base. And then as we've gotten more comfortable and I'm more comfortable with recording and editing, then we'll start bringing guests on to give you information that either I don't have, or I feel like I do have some aspects of it, but I feel like someone can give you a more expansive and in-depth detail. So thank you guys for listening for the first episode. This has been The Culture's Money. I am your host, Jamal, and I'll talk to you guys soon.